You are now listening to the OrthoBullets podcast.
This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will be a question session reviewing multiple choice questions related to odontoid fractures, radial head fractures, and TKA coronal plane balancing, which are three topics that we covered this past week on the podcast. So let's get right into it. We'll start with odontoid fractures, and the first question reads, which of the following is a characteristic of odontoid fractures in children? And the choices are 1, usually occur in the body of C2, 2, are reduced by gentle cervical flexion, 3, frequently progress to non-union, 4, almost always occur at the basilar synchondrosis, and 5, are commonly associated with neurologic injury. So fracture of the odontoid process in children is usually caused by a fall, motor vehicle accident, or minor trauma, and almost always occurs through the synchondrosis at the base of the dens, making answer 4, almost always occurs at the basilar synchondrosis, the correct answer to this question. Neurologic deficits are rare in isolated odontoid fractures in children. Closed reduction by neck extension and immobilization using a cast, a brace, or halo traction for 6 to 8 weeks is usually sufficient to allow the fracture to heal. Moving on to the next question. In elderly patients with type 2 odontoid fractures, which of the following treatment modalities has the highest morbidity and mortality? And the choices are 1, hard cervical collar, 2, anterior screw osteosynthesis, 3, halo vest immobilization, 4, posterior cervical stabilization, and 5, soft cervical orthosis. So elderly individuals with odontoid fractures experience greater rates of morbidity and mortality than younger patients with this injury. Treatment with a halo vest has been associated with increased complications in elderly patient populations and does not allow for immediate mobilization. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Halo vest immobilization is the treatment modality that has the highest morbidity and mortality with elderly patients with type 2 odontoid fractures. Tashjian et al. Reviewed a series of odontoid fractures that are type 2, 3, and combined patterns in elderly patients to evaluate for predictors of in-hospital morbidity and mortality. In those patients treated with a halo vest, 42% died compared with 20% in the non-halo vest group. Major complications occurred in 66% of halo vest patients compared with 36% of non-halo vest patients. Smith et al. Looked at operative versus non-operative treatment of isolated type 2 odontoid fractures in patients aged 80 years and more with neurologic deficit. They reviewed the records of 223 consecutive C2 fractures and concluded that type 2 odontoid fractures in the octogenarian population are associated with substantial morbidity and mortality, irrespective of management method. Moving on to the next question. An 80-year-old man with a history of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease and dementia is involved in a fall from standing height, striking his forehead. He is seen in the emergency department with predominantly mechanical neck pain but no obvious neurologic deficits. Radiographs reveal a non-displaced type 2 odontoid fracture. What is the most appropriate treatment? And the choices are 1, immobilization in a rigid cervical orthosis for 6 to 8 weeks, 2, posterior occipital cervical fusion with iliac crest bone graft, 3, open reduction and internal fixation of the odontoid process with an anterior odontoid screw, 4, resection of the odontoid process through a transoral approach, and 5, halo skeletal fixation. So the treatment options for a type 2 odontoid fracture include halo immobilization, odontoid screw fixation, and posterior atlantoaxial arthrodesis. However, surgical care at this time without attempting non-surgical management is not warranted. Therefore, the most appropriate management at this time is immobilization in a rigid cervical orthosis for 6 to 8 weeks, making 1 the correct answer to this question. Halo vest fixation can lead to high healing rates, but as we discussed, is generally contraindicated in elderly patients, especially one with COPD and dementia. Posterior surgical fusion techniques provide high fusion rates, but do so at the expense of loss of cervical rotation and surgical complications. Resection of a non-displaced odontoid fracture without cord compression via a transoral approach is not necessary. And moving on to the last question for this topic, for a patient with a type 2 odontoid fracture, which of the following factors best predicts the development of a non-union with non-surgical management? And the choices are 1, frontal oblique pattern, 2, magnitude of fracture displacement. 3, degree of posterior angulation. 4, age. And 5, patient history of diabetes mellitus. So all 5 factors have been found to be associated with non-union for type 2 odontoid fractures. Of these, initial fracture displacement of greater than 6 millimeters has the greatest association with the development of fracture non-union. So the correct answer to this question is 2. Magnitude of fracture displacement is the factor that best predicts the development of a non-union with non-surgical management for a type 2 odontoid fracture. Moving on to the next topic of radial head fractures, the first question reads, which of the following structures may help maintain radial length after a radial head fracture? And the choices are 1, triangular fibrocartilage complex, 2, medial ulnar collateral ligament, 3, lateral ulnar collateral ligament, 4, annular ligament, and 5, coronoid. So Essex-Lopresti injuries affect axial stability of the forearm. An injury to the interosseous membrane or the triangular fibrocartilage complex can result in proximal migration of the radius. So the correct answer to this question is 1, the triangular fibrocartilage complex is the structure that may help maintain radial length after a radial head fracture. Moving on to the next question. A 37-year-old man with a non-displaced radial neck fracture has failed to respond to 8 months of non-surgical treatment. He has undergone extensive physical therapy and bracing without improvement. Examination reveals that active and passive range of motion is limited to 50 degrees to 85 degrees with full pronosupination. He has mildly diminished sensation in the little and ring fingers. Radiographs reveal healing of the fracture, no deformity, and no arthrosis or heterotopic bone formation. What is the most appropriate management? And the choices are 1, radial head resection and release of the anterior capsule, 2, anterior and posterior capsule release with ulnar nerve transposition, 3, ulnar nerve transposition and release of the posterior capsule, 4, ulnar nerve transposition, and 5, intraarticular corticosteroid injection. So the patient has refractory extraarticular elbow stiffness and ulnar neuritis following trauma. Important considerations are ruling out failure of fracture healing, persistent deformity, and heterotopic bone formation. In this patient, further non-surgical management is unlikely to provide any benefit. Therefore, the treatment of choice is anterior and posterior capsular release with ulnar nerve transposition, making 2 the correct answer to this question. Radial head resection is not indicated because of the absence of deformity or arthrosis. There is restriction of both flexion and extension, so limited capsular release techniques will not maximize functional restoration. Ulnar nerve transposition alone will not restore motion, and an intraarticular injection is not likely to improve motion 8 months after the injury. Moving on to the next question. In patients with displaced radial neck fractures treated with open reduction and internal fixation with a plate and screws, the plate must be limited to what surface of the radius to avoid impingement on the proximal ulna? And the choices are 1, 2 centimeters distal to the articular surface of the radial head, 2, 1 centimeter distal to the articular surface of the radial head, 3, within a 90-degree arc or safe zone, 4, within a 120-degree arc or safe zone, and 5, within a 180-degree arc or safe zone. So the radial head is covered by cartilage on 360 degrees of its circumference. However, with the normal range of forearm rotation of 160 to 180 degrees, there is a consistent area that is non-articulating. This area is found by palpation of the radial styloid and Lister's tubercle. The hardware should be kept within a 90-degree arc on the radial head, subtended by these two structures. So the correct answer to this question is 3, within a 90-degree arc or safe zone. Moving on to the next question. A 57-year-old woman sustains a posterolateral elbow dislocation. Following close reduction, a displaced radial head fracture of 40% of the joint surface is noted. At surgery, the fragment is found to be comminuted into 4 pieces. What is the best choice for treatment? And the choices are 1, partial radial head excision, 2, radial head excision, 3, radial head replacement, 4, total elbow arthroplasty, and 5, open reduction and internal fixation with prolonged postoperative immobilization. So the injury described is a ligamentous injury because of the dislocation with the radial head fracture. Therefore, the surgical goals are to restore stability to the elbow and allow early range of motion. Only radial head replacement will restore stability and allow early range of motion of the elbow. Radial head excision is not recommended in the setting of any instability because the radiocapitellar joint is an important secondary stabilizer of the elbow. Total elbow arthroplasty is not needed because the ulnohumeral joint is normal. Partial excision of fragments over 30% will likely cause degeneration of the capitellum and will not restore the secondary stabilizing effect of the radial head. Attempts to repair the radial head that cannot achieve rigid fixation are not recommended because they do not restore stability or allow early range of motion. So the correct answer to this question is 3, radial head replacement. Moving on to the next question. What is the best indication for prosthetic radial head arthroplasty following fracture? And the choices are 1, Mason type 1 fracture with full range of motion, 2, Mason type 1 fracture with decreased supination, 3, Mason type 1 fracture with decreased pronation, 4, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane injury, and 5, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane disruption. So the Mason classification differentiates the degree of displacement, angulation, and mechanical block to motion. Most non-displaced radial head fractures that are Mason type 1, in which there is no block to motion, can be treated non-surgically. Mason type 3 injuries are severely comminuted radial head fractures. Fragment excision can be considered in unreconstructable fractures in which the interosseous membrane is intact. However, if the interosseous membrane has been disrupted, fragment excision can lead to proximal migration of the radius with associated wrist problems. In this case, radial head arthroplasty is indicated. Radial head arthroplasty may also be required when the radial head fracture is associated with other ligamentous injuries, as seen following an elbow dislocation, or with an associated unstable coronoid fracture. So the correct answer to this question is 4, Mason type 3 fracture with associated interosseous membrane injury. Moving on to the next question. A patient has an elbow injury that includes a coronoid fracture, medial collateral ligament injury, and a radial head fracture. When is excision of the radial head without replacement indicated as definitive treatment for the radial head injury? And the choices are 1, when the elbow is stable after fixation of the coronoid and medial collateral ligament, 2, when the elbow is unstable after fixation of the coronoid and medial collateral ligament, 3, when the fracture is comminuted and therefore stable internal fixation is unobtainable, 4, when there is pre-existing radiocapitellar arthritis, and 5, excision is generally not indicated in this clinical scenario. So the injury in this question likely represents a terrible triad injury. Restoration of the lateral column is required to restore valgus stability. A repaired or replaced radial head is also thought to be protective of the coronoid fracture repair. Therefore, excision is not indicated. Either radial head arthroplasty or open reduction and internal fixation would be indicated. So the correct answer to this question is 5, excision is generally not indicated in this clinical scenario. Moving on to the next question. What is the best way to determine whether a radial head implant is too thick intraoperatively? And the choices are 1, visually assess the radiocapitellar joint, 2, visually assess widening of the lateral ulnar humeral joint, 3, assess widening of the radiocapitellar joint on an AP radiograph, 4, assess the elbow for concentric reduction on a lateral radiograph, and 5, assess widening of the medial ulnar humeral joint on an AP radiograph. So widening of the medial ulnar humeral joint on an AP radiograph is only visible after over-lengthening of the radial head by 6 millimeters or more. At least in a cadaver study, the most sensitive method was to visually assess the lateral aspect of the ulnar humeral joint with the radial head resected and then with the trial radial head in place. This method allows detection of any over-lengthening. So the correct answer to this question is 2, visually assess widening of the lateral ulnohumeral joint. Moving on to the next question. A healthy 39-year-old male presents to clinic with post-traumatic elbow stiffness after a minimally displaced radial head fracture. His injury occurred 4 months ago with no improvement in range of motion despite 10 weeks of supervised physiotherapy. Follow-up radiographs reveal normal osseous anatomy. What is the next best step in treatment? And the choices are 1, intraarticular and extracapsular cortisone injection, 2, close manipulation under anesthesia, 3, aggressive home exercise program, 4, continuous passive motion device, and 5, static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting. So supervised exercise therapy with static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting over a 6-month period has shown to have the greatest improvement on DASH scores and functional range of motion in patients with post-traumatic elbow stiffness. So the correct answer to this question is 5. Static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting is the next best step in treatment. The goal of treatment in post-traumatic stiffness is to restore a functional range of motion, that is between 30 degrees to 130 degrees. Non-operative modalities are considered the first line of treatment. Aggressive physical therapy has traditionally been advocated. However, the use of static or dynamic progressive elbow splinting with a turnbuckle has shown to provide better functional outcomes. Treatment is usually maintained over a period of 6 to 12 months. Surgery is considered when non-operative therapy fails. Galinas et al. Treated 22 patients with an elbow contracture using a static progressive turnbuckle splint for a mean of 4.5 plus or minus 1.8 months. The mean range of motion improved from between 32 to 108 to between 26 to 127 degrees with a p-value of 0.0001. The results suggest that static progressive splinting is an effective modality for postoperative elbow stiffness. Lyndon Hovius et al. Randomized 66 patients with post-traumatic elbow stiffness into static progressive elbow splint therapy or dynamic elbow splinting over a 12-month period. There was no significant difference in outcomes between the treatment modalities. Range of motion increased by 40 degrees versus 39 degrees at 6 months respectively. DASH scores improved from 50 versus 45 at enrollment to 32 versus 25 at 6 months respectively. Moving on to the next question. A 51-year-old female sustained a comminuted radial head fracture with 4 fragments and an associated elbow dislocation. She was initially close-reduced and splinted with the elbow joint in a reduced position and presented to the orthopedist's office 10 days later. In response to the patient's question of what treatment offers the best chance for a good outcome, the surgeon should recommend, and the choices are 1. Excision of the radial head, 2. ORIF of the radial head, 3. Continued splinting and no surgery, 4. Radial head arthroplasty, and 5. Hinged external fixation. So in the context of elbow instability, optimal treatment of a comminuted radial head fracture with greater than 3 fragments is with a radial head replacement, making 4 the correct answer to this question. Again, radial head fractures are often seen in conjunction with injuries such as elbow dislocations and DRUJ instability. Although minimally displaced injuries can be treated non-operatively, an ORIF can be utilized when there is limited comminution of the radial head. Improved outcomes are demonstrated when radial head arthroplasty is used in the setting of greater than 3 fracture fragments. Ring et al. Reviewed 56 patients who had been treated with an ORIF of the radial head at 48 months after injury. They found that patients had unsatisfactory outcomes for patients who had an ORIF of radial fractures with greater than 3 articular fragments. They recommended ORIF of radial head fractures with 3 or fewer fragments. Morrow et al. Reviewed functional outcomes of patients treated with radial head arthroplasty for unreconstructable fractures. They found that patients treated with metal radial head implants had only mild physical impairment. Short-term follow-up indicates that radial head arthroplasty is a reasonable option for severely comminuted radial head fractures. Moving on to the next question. When performing a Coker approach to the radial head for open reduction internal fixation, the forearm is held in pronation. What structures is this maneuver attempting to protect? What structure is this maneuver attempting to protect? And the choices are 1. Median nerve, 2. Brachial artery, 3. Anterior interosseous nerve, 4. Radial nerve, and 5. Posterior interosseous nerve. So Dilberti et al. Quantified the dimensions of a surgical safe zone with respect to the posterior interosseous nerve when using the posterolateral approach to the radial head between the anconeus and the extensor carpi. They found that the safe zone increased with pronation and decreased with supination. So the correct answer to this question is 5. The posterior interosseous nerve is a structure that pronation is trying to protect in a traditional Coker approach. Moving on to the next question, what is the most common complication following surgery for a terrible triad elbow fracture dislocation? And the choices are 1. Arthritis, 2. Infection, 3. Redislocation, 4. Restricted range of elbow motion, and 5. Posterior interosseous nerve palsy. So, recurrent instability, PIN palsy, infection, and post-traumatic arthritis have all been reported following these injuries. However, elbow contracture or loss of motion is nearly universal following these injuries. So the correct answer to this question is 4. Restricted range of elbow motion is the most common complication following surgery for a terrible triad elbow fracture dislocation. And the final question for this topic, a patient undergoes open reduction and internal fixation of a displaced radial neck fracture. What position should the forearm be in during the approach and during fixation? And the choices are 1. Supinated during the approach and neutral for plate application. 2. Neutral during the approach and pronated for plate application. 3. Pronated during the approach and neutral for plate application. 4. Pronated during the approach and pronated for plate application. And 5. Pronated during the approach and supinated for plate application. So again, this question is similar to one that we recently just did. So pronating the forearm during the surgical approach decreases the danger to the posterior interosseous nerve by moving it away from the surgical field. Placing the plate straight lateral with the forearm in neutral rotation puts the plate in the safe zone that does not articulate with the proximal radial ulnar joint to prevent impingement of the plate during forearm rotation. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Pronated during the approach and neutral for plate application is the position that the forearm should be in during the approach and during fixation. And moving on to the final topic of TKA coronal plane balancing, the first question reads, a 60-year-old male presents with significant left knee pain and end-stage osteoarthritis. He failed non-operative management and is requesting a total knee arthroplasty. His past medical history is significant for a left distal femur fracture that occurred when he was struck by a car 30 years ago. A standing full-length radiograph of his left lower extremity shows a significant coronal plane deformity resulting from a previous distal femur fracture malunion. His femoral coronal plane deformity measures 28 degrees. When proceeding with a total knee arthroplasty, what must be done to address this patient's coronal deformity? And the choices are 1. Soft tissue balancing and intra-articular bone cuts. 2. Distofemoral medial closing wedge osteotomy. 3. Distofemoral lateral closing wedge osteotomy. 4. High tibial osteotomy. And 5. Hinged total knee arthroplasty. So coronal plane deformities of the femur greater than 20 degrees require an extra-articular femoral osteotomy to achieve proper mechanical alignment when performing a total knee arthroplasty. Coronal and sagittal plane deformities of the femur less than 20 degrees can usually be addressed with intra-articular bone cuts and soft tissue balancing. Attempting to correct deformities greater than this without an extra-articular osteotomy can compromise ligamentous stability. This highlights the importance of careful preoperative templating / planning and obtaining full-length standing radiographs when clinically warranted. Although correcting severe deformities with staged or concomitant extra-articular osteotomies can be challenging, they are often successful when properly executed. Lohner et al. Provided a retrospective case series and review article addressing severe extra-articular deformities with simultaneous femoral osteotomy and total knee arthroplasty in patients with osteoarthritis. In their 10-patient series, they were successful in restoring coronal alignment within 2 degrees of anatomic in all patients. They suggest securing the femoral osteotomy site with a plate or locked intramedullary nail, depending on the osteotomy site. Raj Gopal et al. Presented a case series of TKA in 36 knees in the setting of extra-articular deformities. In this series, they treated all patients with intra-articular bone resection and soft tissue balancing to address their deformities. Femoral, coronal, sagittal, and tibial coronal deformities successfully treated included 11 to 18 degrees, 0 to 15 degrees, and 12 to 24 degrees, respectively. But again, the correct answer to this question, when proceeding with a TKA in a patient with a femoral coronal plane deformity that measures 28 degrees, the correct answer is distal femoral lateral closing wedge osteotomy, making 3 the correct answer to this question. But the correct answer to this question is 3. Distal femoral lateral closing wedge osteotomy must be done to address this patient's coronal deformity of 28 degrees. Moving on to the next question. A 65-year-old woman with painful knee arthritis and radiographs demonstrating end-stage arthritis with severe lateral compartment narrowing is scheduled to undergo a total knee arthroplasty. All of the following are risk factors for a postoperative peroneal nerve palsy except. And the choices are 1. Preoperative flexion contracture of greater than 10 degrees. 2. History of lumbar laminectomy. 3. Female gender. 4. Valgus deformity of greater than 12 degrees. And 5. Epidural anesthesia. So the clinical presentation is consistent with end-stage arthritis in a valgus knee, and all the factors listed are risk factors for peroneal nerve palsy except female gender, which is not a risk factor. Peroneal nerve palsy is a potential serious complication of TKA in patients with a preoperative valgus knee deformity. Peroneal nerve palsy is likely caused by lengthening of the lateral aspect of the knee and subsequent traction of the peroneal nerve. It is greatly recommended that patients be evaluated carefully for symptoms postoperatively. If peroneal nerve palsy symptoms are discovered, the knee should be flexed to relax the tension that is effectively being placed on the nerve. If perioperative nerve exploration or decompression is undertaken, the posterior border of the biceps femoris tendon is the proper site of identification. Idusuyi et al. Published a retrospective review of 32 postoperative peroneal nerve palsies in 30 patients in which they identified possible risk factors. Prior proximal tibial osteotomy, lumbar laminectomy, thought to be a double crush phenomenon, and preoperative valgus alignment of 12 degrees or more were all identified as risk factors. Other concerns included epidural anesthesia for post-op pain control, preoperative flexion contractures, and tourniquet time greater than 120 minutes also increased concern. Favorito et al. Reviewed valgus total knee arthroplasty and reported that the most common complications of patients with the valgus deformity include tibiofemoral instability, that is between 2% to 70%, recurrent valgus deformity between 4% to 38%, postoperative motion deficits requiring manipulation between 1% to 20%, wound problems between 4% to 13%, patellar stress fracture or osteonecrosis, that is between 1% to 12%, patellar tracking problems, that is between 2% to 10%, and peroneal nerve palsy, between 3% to 4%. Moving on to the next question. A 68-year-old woman who has right knee pain that is limiting her activity and has severe preoperative valgus deformity comes to your office. During total knee arthroplasty, what pathologic features are typically encountered? And the choices are 1. Lateral femoral hypoplasia, 2. Internal rotation of the tibia relative to the femur, 3. Medial patella tracking, and 4. Tight medial collateral ligament. So in patients with severe valgus deformity, problems frequently encountered include loose or attenuated medial collateral ligament, tight lateral retinaculum and lateral ligamentous structures, that is the lateral collateral and posterolateral corner, atrophic lateral femoral condyle, lateral patella tracking, and external rotation of the tibia relative to the femur. The hypoplastic lateral condyle can cause internal rotation of the anteroposterior cutting block if the posterior condylar line is used for rotational alignment. The medial soft tissues are typically attenuated and stretched. But the correct answer to this question is 1. Lateral femoral hypoplasia is the pathologic feature that is typically encountered during a total knee arthroplasty for a severe preoperative valgus deformity. And the final question for this topic, performing an isolated release of the popliteus tendon during a total knee arthroplasty is most appropriate in which of the following scenarios? And the choices are 1. Valgus deformity that is tight in extension, 2. Varus deformity that is tight in extension, 3. Valgus deformity that is tight in flexion, 4. Valgus deformity that is tight in both flexion and extension, and 5. Varus deformity that is tight in flexion. So an isolated release of the popliteus tendon during TKA is most appropriate in the setting of a valgus knee deformity that is tight in flexion. Lateral collateral ligament release is most appropriate for a valgus deformity that is tight in both flexion and extension. Iliotibial band release is indicated if the knee is tight in extension. For varus knee deformities, femoral and tibial osteophyte removal, release of the deep MCL, release of the posterior medial corner, release of the attachment of the semimembranosus, and partial superficial MCL release may be sequentially indicated to achieve coronal balancing. The review article by Favorito et al. Discusses the controversy over the correct order and sequence for anatomic release of the lateral structures, with some authors preferring not to release the LCL as an initial step. The case control study by Krakow et al. Found good success with a lateral release in valgus deformity that had competent medial structures. In cases with incompetent medial structures, they reported good success with reconstruction and imbrication of the medial structures. So the correct answer to this question is 3. Performing an isolated release of the popliteus tendon during a total knee arthroplasty is most appropriate in a valgus deformity that is tight in flexion. So that's all for this question review session about odontoid fractures, radial head fractures, and TKA coronal plane balancing. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.